Okay. Let's get back to business, and I've hardly started here. One little practical thought. Wherever you are and however inundated with people you are where you live, find a closet. I remember being, as we left our careers, my husband was a bank inspector catching criminals in the bank. I was teaching them in the classroom, so we had a lot in common when we met. And we left our careers and went to serve a youth mission that started as a German mission to ex-Nazi youth after the Second World War, and have been with that organization ever since. Now 17 years, we travel worldwide for them. And why did I tell you that? It had nothing to do with anything. Never mind. Closet, thank you. You guys, you need to travel with me, okay? Oh, my word. Closet, yes, 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 find your closet. And so in this big castle that became the Bible School and Outreach Center for Britain, and then Europe and the rest of the world, it's in 26 countries now, and that was our work to plant that mission church all around the world. And in that place, I was at one of the gatehouses, the little cottages. If you think Downton Abbey, but huge, and then think of the little gatehouses at all the places that come into the property. And it looked very romantic and tiny. It was very difficult to have three kids and various street kids I'd bring home off the streets. And it was there was nowhere I could find a closet. They didn't even have a closet in a 17th century little building like that. And so living there, never free from people, where was I going with my children very small? Where was I going to have time with God? It was very frustrating. And I said to the Lord after reading, enter your closet and speak to God, you know. I said, Lord, I don't even have a closet in the house. And I sort of was nudged to look for a place. And I couldn't leave my little children, you know, they're all under whatever. And so I said, Lord, show me then in the house. And my eye fell on the playpen, so I got in and put them out. So I could see what, and you know, it was easy. You say, but Jill, when they run into trouble, no. The only time they wanted to get in was when I put them out. So they stayed and rattled the bars to try and get to me, but I was safe from their sticky little fingers and everything was wonderful. So I take my Bible and my cup of tea, which is what you do in times of crisis if you're British, and I would get in and say, I'll get out and play for you in 10 minutes and just leave me alone, I'm meeting with Jesus. Well, years and years later, I went up to see my son in his church up in Michigan, and I'm sitting there a proud mom to be ministered to by your husband is one blessing, but to be ministered to by your children, all of whom are kids are in ministry, you can't buy that. You can't buy it. And I was so proud to go to his first little church, and I was sitting there, and all the country ladies, that's his mother. And to my horror, he began to tell this story about me and his playpen. So all these ladies, you know, and then I wished I was on the back seat. And then I thought, what, that he would even remember? Well, you'd remember if your mother was in your playpen, right? So would I. And so I lost the problem of being watched by the entire church. And I thought, what's he going to say? And he said, my sister and I, what were they, 4 and 2, or 5 and 3, I don't know, somewhere in there. No, 4 and 2. Learned to leave my mother alone when she was in our playpen. This was application time. So we're all on the edge of our seats, me included, because children, especially small ones, always do what is to their advantage. And my mother was a whole lot nicer mummy when she got out than when she got in. I assure you, I was not modeling anything. I was desperate. But I was. something happened to Mommy that made her a whole lot nicer Mommy when she got out. And it was something to do with their Bible and her cup of tea and Jesus. And it sort of stuck. So find your closet. I have to tell you, years ago, it must be late 70s. We came in 1970 to the church. So it must have been late 70s when I began to speak to women's deals. I gave this illustration. And, well, it's well over 25, 30 years ago, isn't it? Thank you. I'm really bad with numbers. And somewhere in the last month, this lady comes up to me and says, I was at that meeting when you told about the playpen all those years ago, Jill, in a church somewhere or other. And she said, did anybody ever tell you what happened in our little town? And I said, no, what happened? She said, well, Toys R Us are there. And she said, they sold out of playpens. I said, no, nobody ever told me that, but that's very interesting. So you never know what you're modeling, right? Anyway, all that to say, find a place. If you can, walk into the cathedral. Walk into outside. The invisible things of God are clearly seen in the things he has made. That's the cathedral all around us. I honestly think I love California, but you should come visit me in the upper part of Wisconsin against Canada in the mountains and the hills. We have a cathedral. And if you can, if you're working, take your lunch once a week and walk out into the cathedral. Find a place. Find a time. For me, I would take my calendar off the wall at the beginning of every week. I've kept the habit. And according to what I was doing, I put my time with God at different times. There was no way I could have my time with God unless it was very early in the morning or very late at night. Our church would tell you that one of the mantras that Stuart sent our congregations out after Sunday morning, four times we would have a congregation in, and he would say, never put your head on the pillow at night, and they would join in, unless your nose has been in the book during the day. Okay? And I meet people all over the world that say, hey, I visited your church once, and never put your head on the pillow at night. Never put your head on the pillow at night, if necessary. But try and find each day and put it down. Time with God, time with God. For me, every day is different. If you have a routine, bless you. It's easier if you have a routine to see the best time for you. And don't give God the tail end of your day when you're exhausted. Try and find a good time to meet with God and learn the book, etc., etc. So let's get back to the story of Elijah here, which we haven't started on yet. So I started in the sense of him praying according to the will of God, revealed in the word of God. Are you willing to become the answer to your own prayer? And off he went to become the answer to his own prayer. And he faces off with Ahab. Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, this is 17 verse 1, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. Then the word of the Lord came to, that little word came to, you'll see it all the way through the Old Testament. The word of the Lord came to Moses, the word of the Lord came to all the prophets, it always, and it in the Hebrew, it's very interesting, it means he never calls without equipping. Go to, and as you go, you find the power to do it. It's back to my illustration, after obedience. Came to means the word of God came to with power to move you physically to get your act together as you go. Came to God with power, it means. As the Lord the God of Israel lives, whom I serve. Then he gives the message that he had received at Tishbe. There will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Leave here, turn eastward, hide in the Kerith ravine, east of the Jordan. You'll drink from the brook. I've ordered the ravens to feed you there. Actually, the biggest miracle of this whole story is this. Would you have taken meat out of the beak of a raven? Where does it get its meat from? Dead animals. And he did it. That must have been a test. Except it must have been quite incredible to see them arriving with breakfast on time. But it took, what did it take this guy to take meat from a scavenger bird? He didn't order the sparrows. I would have found that easier myself, but never mind. As the Lord of God whom I serve, there will be, etc. And so he hid him in this ravine. When God hides a man, he hides a man. And I could stay here for the rest of the day and tell you about the church under communism, the church under terrorism. If it isn't your number yet, he'll hide you. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, leave here, turn eastward. So he goes there, and there's a little river. And he settles in there. And I don't know whether he began to say, I miss my mom and dad, and maybe I'm here for the rest of my life, I don't know. He guessed the soldiers were looking for him. It says in the book of Chronicles, I think, in the history, that they look for Elijah in every country around except one country. They didn't bother looking for him in Jezebel's hometown. Interesting. That's exactly where God said, go there. And he went. So here he is, he's safe, and I don't know if he settled in. But there came a point where God said, okay, leave here and get yourself to Zarephath, which was Jezebel's hometown, Sidon. And it tells you the countries, the army looked for him in that period of time. Sidon is not mentioned. They didn't bother. Why would they bother looking in Jezebel's? He wouldn't have gone there. And I love it because I think of the whole history of the church under communism, how God used to hide people in the most ridiculous places that God knew would be safe. And they said, well, he certainly wouldn't have gone, because as you come in, I've been there with Holy Land trips that we've led, as you enter there, they've dug up Sidon, Jezebel's hometown, and the palace where she was brought up is absolutely at the gate you enter. So Jezebel was brought up as you walk in the gate of the ruins there. Here's the ruins of the palace. And in sight of the palace, God hid him for 2.5 years. Yes! Well, he wouldn't go there, said the Jezebel, and he wouldn't go to Sidon, but let's send him here, and let's send him over there, and let's look for him here. When God hides a man, he hides a man. They wouldn't look for him in the ravine. How would he stay alive? I mean, they weren't reckoning on the birds of the air feeding him and whatnot, so they didn't look for him in all those sort of hiding places. And so God took care of him. He wasn't finished yet. It wasn't time for him to go to heaven. But sometime later, the brook dried up because there'd been no rain in the land. That's his fault. He'd prayed there wouldn't be. He became a victim of the answer to his own prayer. That's very complicated, but it's difficult when something like that happens. So, in other words, maybe he got too comfortable, and the only way God could move him on was taking out the water. Sometimes it's circumstances is the only thing that will move us on or move us out. And he really had no option. Like everything else, he'd die like the cattle if he stayed when there was no water. But, and give him the benefit of the doubt, go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. Really? You mean just, yes. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food. So he went. Lord, I want to be that obedient. So he went. When he came to the town, a widow was there gathering sticks for her last meal because the drought had affected Sidon, like all the countries around. And she was making her last meal before they died of starvation. So she had a little boy, you know the story, and she was picking up sticks for her last meal. This man, he's been living rough. Imagine what he looked like. He appears, but he's obviously an Israeli guy by his garments. And he says, give me your last meal. And she does. She is dressed as a Sidon woman who, every time she worshipped Baal or Ashtoreth, would give her body to the priests or the priestesses for sex. And her clothes told him that. But you see, God looks on the heart, we look on the outside. And I remember coming to this part and saying, Lord, I needed to see that. We look on the outside, but God looks on the heart. And the most unlikely, and now I know this from street work, the gangs, the guys with chains on their backs and broken bottles in their pockets they put in your face, and razor blades in the tips of their shoes they put against your feet. And yet it was some of the toughest, hardest kids. And God looked at their heart, and they were yelling out, if only someone would tell me, if only someone would tell me. So was this widow woman. God said, I have prepared a widow woman. Would you think of it to look at her? Never. Never. And he had. She's picking up sticks. This wild man appears and says, and she takes him home and shares her last meal with him. And that's where God hid him for 2.5 years, approximately. Under the nose of the palace in Sidon. Very safe place. Very safe place. When God hides a man, he hides a man. And there's an incident here that is amazing. And you know the story well. She had a little boy who's probably very malnourished. And it says that after a long time, maybe a year, he died. Most people think it was malnourished. If you've ever been, as I've had the privilege, serving World Relief for many years on their board of visiting starving areas, it's terrible to see people starving to death, but there are certain characteristics. And the word finally here, the little boy, even though God provided food and oil that never ran out, you know the story, when Elijah was there, miraculously, food was provided for the family through those 2 years while everybody else starving to death all around. That's a miracle in itself. But probably he was too far gone. And if you know anything about it, I only know because I've had the privilege of being there and asking the doctors questions. You get to a point in your body, the only thing that'll save you is hospital and a drip. And of course, there were no hospitals or drips. And it says, finally died. And the word is, after a long, drawn out, hard time, he died. And the widow woman, who's been listening to stories for 1.5 years about God taking Israel through the Red Sea and dealing with miracles and everything, said, why did you ever come into my life? You told me your God was greater than Baal. You told me stories of what he'd done. It's all lies. I watched you praying to this Jehovah. I was praying to Baal one side of the boy, and you were praying to Jehovah the other. I wish you'd never come into my life. And Elijah, in total turmoil, having prayed the other side of the bed to Jehovah, until he finally died, was saying inside, God, why did you ever bring me here? But he put out his hands and said, give me your child. And he climbed to the upper room, stretched him out before the Lord, stretched himself onto him, and went to prayer for life in some form. And that's the word that's used in James in the Hebrew and the Greek. Stretched out fervent prayer of a man right with God achieves much. And he prayed and life came. Hollywood don't know this, doesn't know this exists, this incredible story. And Elijah picked him up and, hey, come, he's alive, and comes down the stairs and she's there. And the last verse, then the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you're a man of El, which is the word for God that means creator, giver of life, giver of fire, giver of rain. Now I know you are a God of El that you've been talking about. Creator God, creator of life. You are a man of El. And that the word of the Lord, she uses the word for Jehovah, the personal name of God. He's not a God that created us and went away and decided he'd go create some more universes and wasn't interested in us. He stayed and won us back forever. I know that you are a man of El, creator God of life, and that the word of the Lord, Jehovah, one who is involved, cares about death and dying and children that you've been telling me about, he'd done his work. She even knew the names of God and what they meant. From your word is truth, and she comes to faith. First convert in the whole of Sidon. Actually, the descendants in the New Testament is Samaria. Interesting. Elijah's cry, boy's life returns, and he comes. You know, remember why I was studying this? Because of my daughter-in-law leaving our son and all of this. This is why I'm in all of this. And what the Lord encouraged me with was this story and gave me a picture of what I needed to do. And that was to take my boy in my arms of prayer up to the upper room, lay him out to the Lord, and do the work until life in some way came into this terrible situation. And it's such a picture, and it gave me a picture as I traveled the world at that time to say to missionaries whose kids were in trouble, give me your child. I'll do the work of prayer. And that's what we need to say to each other. Give me your child. Take them up to the upper room and pray till life in some way comes into the situation. And don't know where my wonderful Spanish interpreter is, but I'm going to use this story in God's Front Door that I think you took a picture of. And I'll read it slowly so that you can translate it. It's called Cradle Him for Me. These little books are what I told you about. The Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groans that words cannot express. Romans 8:26. I ran to the front door. Sitting on the steps, I waited. Today was a terrible day. It was dark and cold outside, and the weather matched my heart. He whom I love came quietly outside and sat on the steps beside me. Lord, someone I have loved, is divorcing our firstborn today. I know, he said simply. Well, I'm in so much emotional pain I can hardly breathe. I can't imagine how our son feels. I hate divorce, he said quietly. I had something so much better in mind, so much pain. Then he added, if the father wills, the firstborn drinks a cup of sorrow. Remember my nail-pierced hands hold the goblet. He helped me pen a poem after a time, and I gave it to our firstborn later when the dark day was over. He helped me put the words on paper wet with tears. and he promised me he would be waiting in the courtroom. He was. Dear son, this cup of sorrow must be drunk. It is for thee. But be sure he holds the goblet, dear son, 'tis he. Hurting one, he is your father, saw his son upon the cross. Understanding pain and parting, know so well your loss. Bruised was he, but never broken, dim the flax burns in the storm. He will strengthen you with power. He will lead you home. Firstborn of beloved children, joy and pride we have in thee. Father, hear this mother's heartbeat. Cradle him for me. Cradle him for me. Cradle him for me. Father, hear this mother's heartbeat. Cradle him for me. Take them to the upper room, folks. Yours. And everyone you can. Pray for this broken generation, like Elijah did. Fervently, stretched out in the situation, so it costs you something. It costs some people something if we're going to intercede for a lost and hurting world. There's a price to pay for this sort of prayer, but it's absolutely growing more and more essential as days go by. So after the woman says, "Now I know that you're a man of God, and the word of the Lord from your mouth is truth," after a long time, about 2.5 years, we don't know when that happened, probably halfway through it, the word of the Lord, there we go again, came to Elijah with power, never calls without equipping, he never calls without giving you the power, not the feeling, the power to be obedient, came to Elijah, "Go! Present yourself to Ahab. Yes, he's had the whole army looking for you, but go and face up to him. Leave your safe place and just go and have a little talk with Ahab." Really? You must be kidding. So Elijah went. Wow. He went to present himself. Now the famine was severe, and Ahab had summoned Obadiah. Oh, I'd love to give you a whole hour on Obadiah. He was the secret believer in the palace. He was the one that was listening to Jezebel saying, "Let's go and get those believers in Jehovah and kill them." And somebody was spiriting them away before she got there and hiding them in caves and keeping them fed. So he was a Daniel in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. He was a Joseph. He was helping the church, if you wish. He was helping the believers. And God had left him in the palace serving Ahab. Ahab and Jezebel, of course, had no idea, or he would be toast. And so Obadiah was with Ahab looking desperately for water as all their cattle are dying and it's well into the famine and nothing. The sky is as blue and the sun is as hot as it's ever been. The famine was severe in Samaria. And Ahab summoned Obadiah, who was in charge of his palace. Obadiah was a devout believer in the Lord. And while Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, 50 in each, and had supplied them with food. Can you imagine this? This would make a good Hollywood movie. Ahab had said to Obadiah, "Go through all the land, to all the springs and valleys. Maybe we can find some grass to keep the horses and mules alive, so we will not have to kill any of our animals." So they divided the land and they were to cover. And Ahab goes one way and Obadiah goes another. And as Obadiah is walking along, Elijah met him. Obadiah recognized him, bowed to the ground and said, "Is that really you, my Lord Elijah?" "Yes," he wrote. "Go and tell your master Elijah is here." "What have I done wrong?" he said. "You're handing your servant over to Ahab to be put to death. As surely as the Lord your God lives, there's not a nation or kingdom where my master hasn't sent someone to look for you. And whenever a nation or kingdom claimed you weren't there, he made them swear they could not find you. And now you're telling me to go and tell my master he's round the corner. It'll kill me because I know the Spirit of the Lord's going to whip you away and I'm going to come and he's going to say, you told me he was here. Elijah said, come. I'll stay here. I promise you. Go and tell him I'm here. And so very bravely, Obadiah, hoping it's going to be true, goes and says, I just met Elijah around that tree. And Ahab meets Elijah. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. And when he saw Elijah, he said to him, is that you, you troubler of Israel? I haven't made trouble for Israel, says Elijah, but you and your father's family have. You've abandoned the Lord's commands. You've followed the Baals. Now, summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Interesting, he brought the prophets, but he never did bring the prophetesses. So Ahab sent word through all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Have you ever thought about that? He just did what Elijah told him to do. Why? I honestly believe because he promised him rain. There is no other reason. And Ahab knew somehow Elijah had the power. As he said, him and Jehovah had stopped it, he had the power to bring it again. He would never have gone and brought all those people. And maybe, I don't think his wife knew, but maybe he thought, if I tell Jezebel that I want all her prophetesses here, she's not going to let me do it. And I do believe this man, somehow, that we've hunted down, has the power to bring rain. The only way I can think is that he got the leaders of Israel and the prophets there, and that's what most commentaries say. And so now we have this incredible story you've heard in Sunday school. This is the bit of Elijah's story that we usually hear, isn't it? Fire on the mountain. And when he gets them there, the prophets of Baal do their thing, cutting themselves and calling to their gods. And there's a very sad verse here, but there was none to hear. None to heed. No fire. Oh, Baal, answer us, they shouted, but there was no response. No one answered, and they danced around the altar they'd made. I've been in places like that. I've been where the dancing dervishes. I've never felt more evil in my life than in that place down at that time of worship of those people in Africa. No, wherever I was, Asia, I think. And the atmosphere is something I can never experience, and I tell you, great fear for any believer that happens to be around those festivals that they have. And so all that's going on, and Elijah starts to taunt them. And they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Oh, Baal, answer us! But there was no response, and no one answered, and they danced around the altar they'd made, and they cut themselves. I've seen this happening. I've seen people crawling up on their knees into the Hindu temples, and their knees bleeding, and it's just heartbreaking. But there's none to answer. No, they are no gods. Only God is God. Only God is God. And he taunts them. Shout louder. Surely he's a god. Perhaps he's in deep in thought, or he's busy, or he's traveling. Maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until the blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice, but there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. I remember standing watching that Hindu temple at prayer time and just weeping, because there was none to hear and none to answer. And they don't know. They don't know. Then Elijah said, come here to me. And they came to him, and he did three things. He repaired the altar that Jezebel had broken down, the altars of the Lord, remember, which was a symbol of Israel's relationship with God. Broken those and put Baal's altars up in their place. Elijah repaired the altar of the Lord on Mount Carmel. If you go to the Holy Land, you can go to Mount Carmel. You can be there in that place, and you can see those broken altars all around. It is the place. It's the Elijah scene, and it's one of my favorite places to go in the Holy Land. And so he repairs the altar, which means it was the beginning of the repairing of Israel and Jehovah's relationship. And he puts all the stones back in place. And then he makes the sacrifice, and the sacrifice was the sin sacrifice, which had to be in the tabernacle continual. The animal was slaughtered. By the time it was finished, another one was ready to be put on. It was continual sacrifice for sin. That's why it says in Hebrews, there is now left no continual sacrifice needed. Jesus, one sacrifice for all at the cross, etc. But back here, it was one animal after the other, and that's the only sacrifice that had to keep being made, the sacrifice for sin. And so he builds the altar. He commits the sacrifice on it, and then he says, I've done everything you told me. And he says, if you really want to see God's power, bring that water. Bring the water barrels you've hauled up here to the mountain. Soak the thing. Soak it. Pour the water out. And they did. The time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord God of Abraham, O Lord God, personal God, El, God of thunder, God of lightning, God of fire, O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known, today you are God, Creator God. Then the fire fell. A little interesting thing I can tell you is if you visit Hiroshima or Nagasaki, you'll go to the museum. Terrible, terrible day when you visit that. It always is for me. And see what happens when you drop an atom bomb. There's a glaceous substance left. Only an atom bomb can create. And the same substance is found in this place on Mount Carmel. They've dug it up. What is this? And in one of the scientific things, it says, the only other place in the world. I don't know if that's true or not. Well, I know it's true that they found the same substance where God sent down lightning, fire, and took the altar. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, and the stones. Atomic fire is the only thing that melts stone in the world. I mean, now we've got more than that, and I'm sure it's easy now. But this is then. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord Jehovah, personal God, is God, G-O-D, creator, God of the weather, etc. He's God, He's the Lord, He's the Lord." Then Elijah commanded them, and they seized the prophets of Baal. Don't let any get away. They seized them and took them down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered them there. And then Elijah said to Ahab, "Go, eat and drink, for there is the sound of heavy rain." And Elijah climbed to the top, and he put his face between his knees, and he said to his servant, whoever he was, where did he find him? I think the four servants that appear in this story and disappear. So to be a servant of Elijah is not a good idea. They just disappear and God provides him with another one. Where did he find him? He came straight from there, from hiding with the widow of Zarephath. He and his servant climbed to the top and went to prayer. It's all very well to see fire on your altar, but you need to pray for the rain of revival. Rain of revival. And they stayed there until they saw the little cloud, no bigger than a man's hand. Like, yes! And they ran down the mountain. And here is Ahab still in his chariot, not wanting to go and face his wife. Get it? because all the prophets' heads are bouncing down the river in her direction and would have reached her by then. And sure enough, Elijah puts his cloak around him, only Elijah would do this, and runs in front of the horses. Why didn't he take a lift or do something? But that's Elijah. Do you know anyone like that? I'm married to a man like that. He'll run in front of the horses instead of taking a lift. And here he is. Now think of how exhausted he must have been. How many days did he fast before that? What's he been through immediately before? Physically, emotionally, spiritually, taking on the entire nation in that battle of battles and seeing the fire fall. Climbing the mountain after that and praying until on their knees they saw the rain coming. Running down the mountain. If you read the story, how many times he went up and down that mountain, that's quite a journey in this story. And then here's Ahab and he says, it's going to rain, your chariot wheels are going to get stuck in the mud, go home. And then he runs in front of it, in front of the chariot. And if you look on your maps, you'll see it's probably half a marathon to the gates. And Jezebel's messenger meets him and says, I'm going to get your head like you got their heads by tonight. I'm going to leave it for my last message. And Elijah was afraid, and he ran for his life. And he ended up under a broom tree saying, I want to die, take my life. I'm done. I've underlined that how many times Elijah was afraid. And of course, the last triumph of the last piece we'll keep till we come back. But let me just ask you, have you repaired the altar? What part of your relationship with God has been broken? Have you put the stones back in place? Have you reminded yourself of the sacrifice that's been made for sin? Not just the sin, past, present, and future, but as 1 John says, Christians should continue to pray in confession for sin. Why is that? I get asked all over the world. Well, it's John that says to the church, pray for the continual cleansing from sin. Now, this isn't the sin that stops you going to heaven. This is the daily things that stop your relationship with God. It's the prodigal son. It isn't sin that will keep us in heaven, or it isn't that sin. It's the sin that spoils the fellowship of the Son and the Father. You've got kids, we've got 2 boys. Thank God neither of our boys have ended up in the pigsty. If they had, we would have had to watch in prayer for them coming home and run to them when we saw them come out of the pigsty they'd made for themselves. And the confession would have had to be made by the prodigal. I'm so sorry, Father. And then our fellowship as parents and child would be renewed. That's the reason Christians need to say sorry. Not because of sin, but because of the fellowship that's been broken between you or church members or whatever. Read 1 John 1 and it'll make sense to you now. If that's not part of your prayer, you're missing something, and I'll attend to that when I pick it up afterwards. I think that's my time. So, we race through that story and I'll apply it when we come back. Let's pray. Father dear, we praise you because we have the privilege that